about fly fishing internet radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dick Cameron, and he'll be answering your most important questions on permit on the fly in Yucatan's Ascension Bay. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the internet. If you'd like to ask Dick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dick Cameron about permit on the fly in Yucatan's Ascension Bay. Get ready to visit the International Sportsman's Exposition nearest you. In Phoenix, from March 7th through March 9th, and in Salt Lake City, March 13th through March 16th. Each ISE show spotlights 400 to 600 plus exhibitors, including fly shops and hundreds of lodges, guides, and outfitters from across the West, Canada, Alaska, and even South America. Watch ISE's Best of the West Distance Casting Contest. Learn from the best local fly tires at our How-To Center and Fly Tying Video Theater. Meet fly fishing legends and next-generation stars at ISE's Fishing Theater. Clouser, Dennis, Rickards, Blanton, O'Keefe, Gunn, Patine, Dorsey, dozens more. Watch film premieres of Soulfish by Mikey Weir and Equilibrium by Dr. Grant Wiswell. Schedules and info online right now at sportsexpos.com. That's sportsexpos.com. Well, before we introduce Dick, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, just go to our homepage and look right under Dick's section there where it says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that, fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate, compliments of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. Now, here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in that text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills when the time comes. First person to send in the correct answer will win the $20 gift certificate that you can redeem either online, Front Range Anglers, or in their store. Our guest tonight is Dick Cameron. Dick grew up in southeast Alaska. He learned about commercial fishing, hunting, and sport fishing, but with subsistence motivations. He learned to fly fish in 1990, rather late in life, and instantly found it to be one of the most rewarding forms of fishing he had experienced to that point. It didn't take Dick long to catch the travel bug, and in June of 1992, he took a trip with a few friends down to the west side of the Everglades. Everything about it was exciting to him, especially the sight fishing, which gave the whole experience a hunting sort of feel. In the spring of 1993, he booked 8 days in the Florida Keys during the tarpon migration. He fished 6 days with Captain Rob Fortas and was completely vexed by the Silver King. His fly fishing life was forever changed from that point on. He collected gear, attended trade shows, worked on his casting, and constantly planned the next trip. In the winter of 94, Dick went full-time into the sport fishing for hire industry in southeast Alaska. His primary focus was conventional light tackle fishing for salmon, halibut, and lingcod, but they offered fly-out fly fishing day trips as well. This left the winter with plenty of time to head for the tropics. In the fall of 2000, he was offered a job of managing a prestigious flats fishing lodge in Punta Allen, Mexico, the Palometa Club, which he took, of course, and that was 8 years ago, and the chapter is still being written. Either personally or through the accounts of his friends, clients, and guides, Dick has experienced over 800 permit landed and countless hundreds more hooked or near hooked. Dick, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, good to have you. I know you're going through some extra efforts to be with us tonight, folks. He's down in the Yucatan. He had to travel through the jungle, probably on some god-awful road to get to where he could cell signal. But you made it, huh, Dick?
I did make it, and fortunately the mule knows the way pretty well, and there weren't too many livestock we had to move out of the way. But I'd like to correct that bio just a little tiny bit.
Oh, sure.
When I came down to the Yucatan, it was to manage the Ascension Bay Bonefish Club, and the Palometa Club is just in its third year of rocking and rolling down here in Ascension Bay.
Oh, okay. So you've moved to a different lodge then down there.
Yeah, this is my eighth season down here, and the people and the place of Punta Allen is something that captured my heart in the very first season that I was down here, and it reminded me so much of some of the small places that I grew up in Southeast, where the people were just so genuine and hardworking and honest, and it's what's really captivated me and kept me here through a lot of challenges. Like I said, this is the third year for our own deal for the Palometa Club. I couldn't be happier.
Well, great. What's the temperature there right now?
Let me see. It's 82 right now,
82.
And I'm 82, and I'm happy to say that I haven't touched a snow shovel in months.
Yeah. Well, for some of us, that's not the case. But anyway, I just had to ask just so that I would be a little bit jealous up here. That's something we'd all like to do, is go warm our bones a bit in the wintertime. Well, let's get down to talking about fishing here. First, folks, what we're going to try to do is, as per usual, we're going to try to cover a lot of aspects of the permit in this case, and talking specifically about the Yucatan eastern coast there where permit are plentiful. But let's talk first of all about the fish itself. A lot of us freshwater fishermen have not had this experience or do not know about the fish. So, Dick, why don't you tell us a little bit about the permit itself, what family it's in, what it looks like, what its spawning habits are, things like that. Just let us get to know the fish a little bit.
Okay, well, a permit is in the jack family, and it's not a very specific family. That houses trevally and, of course, all the various species of jacks, including roosterfish. But the permit is a little bit different in its nature because it's not quite as voracious and aggressive as most of the jack species that you think of when you think of a jack crevel or other things like that. Their diet is much more specific. Even though they will eat fish on occasion, they do mostly stick to crustaceans, shrimp, crab, baby conch, that sort of thing. Their range is also very limited, whereas most jacks inhabit almost all the tropics or subtropics around the world. Permit only live from the Florida at its northern range down through some of the Caribbean islands, the eastern coast of the Caribbean, of Mexico, Belize, Honduras. There's a few as far south as Venezuela, but the main concentration is right in this area from the northern tip of the Yucatan Peninsula up at Isla Cantoy or Isla Holbosch south to Honduras, basically nicknamed the permit coast. So it's an incredible fish in that it's not easily fooled with fur and feathers. And I think most saltwater anglers that have made many casts to permit will back me up on that statement. The only thing I could equate it to in freshwater would be a steelhead.
In other words, you don't catch too many very often, right?
Well, no, you don't. But fortunately, it's a game of numbers. You need to see a lot to get chances at a few, and you need to get chances at a lot to get a few to follow, and you need to get a lot to follow to get a few to take, and you need to get a lot to take to land one. With that being said, this is one of the better areas for you to get a chance to get those opportunities to see that many fish, to take the shots that you need to make the mistakes that need to happen in order for you to eventually hook up and be successful and get one to hand.
Well, it's interesting you had mentioned steelhead, because our last show was with Deck Hogan, and it was on steelhead. And he explained it like this. He said, think of it more like if you were going out hunting for a moose or a bear or a deer. You work that whole season for that one animal, and that one animal is a trophy, no matter what size or what it is or what the rack is. And he kind of related that to the steelhead, and I guess we could talk about the permit too. It's one of the ultimate game fishes and one of the ultimate challenges out there, and they just don't come that easy.
That's the truth. And we had a client in my early years down here that had been coming to Ascension Bay for 7 years, and he had the best attitude of any angler I've ever been around. And all of his days were successful, but in that time that I knew him, he never landed one. But his comment at the end of the day was, oh, enjoyed the number of fish, saw the number of fish that he got shots at, the amount of follows that he had, because, you know, he was really taken by the journey, not necessarily a destination. I think there's more of us that do want to land one, but it's nice to have guys like that understand it and keep it all in perspective and really realize that they're in a cool place and you're seeing lots of fish and there's fun to be had at every turn.
Right. Now, what kind of water do they like? Where would we look for them?
Well, of course, that varies a little bit with the area that you're looking for them in. You know, like the Florida Keys, you look for them on the edges of the turtle grass and the coral where they're able to find stuff to eat. They're in about 8 to 10 feet of water, and they're stemming the current. You know, they'll sit in the current and let food kind of come to them. Down here in this area, we don't have a lot of current, particularly inside the bay, and the fish, they stick and move. They'll hit an area that's got some feed, and when you see them feeding, and even when they're stopping and tailing up, they don't stop at any one place for any real length of time because they're chasing the food that, you know, not got current that's holding them in one place. So in our area down here, we'll see them in anywhere from 2 to 5 feet of water, and we see them tailing a lot, and we're able to get out of the boat and actually make casts to them, you know, on foot, which is a real exciting aspect of the sport that doesn't exist in a lot of locations.
Well, what are some of their habits then? Do they feed during certain times of day more actively than other times of day, or are they just constantly out there on the feed?
Well, the ones that we have here they're local fish. They're not migratory in any aspect, but I think like most fish, they feed when there's an opportunity to feed. The whole controversy versus full moon versus not full moon, you know, I could go back to my logbooks and tell you that, you know, we've had times during the full moon that the daytime fishing was shut off. We've got other times during the full moon where the daytime fishing was red hot. So it's more an aspect of water temp, what else is going on in the area at the time, than the lunar cycles, because I really do believe that they feed when there's an opportunity. The permit, however, it seems like once they get on a specific food, the conventional wisdom is that they eat crabs most of the time. But I've seen them tailing and so aggressively feeding and put 6 different flies on in the span of a half an hour casting to the same fish to not ever have a look at the fly that I threw out there, because it had to have been feeding on something so specific that I couldn't replicate it with anything in my fly box. So it's that's one of the things that makes this fish so unique and such a challenge.
Well, when you said earlier you don't have the current, I think you said you don't have the current down there in Ascension Bay.
We don't have the current like they have in the Keys.
So in the Keys, like with bonefish, you're waiting for the change of the tide when a lot of water moving and the fish move with the water. You don't have that same kind of activity then down in where you are.
We have it to a very slight degree. You know, a large tide here is a foot or 18 inches. That's a large tide change. And we've got the Maya Reef that acts as a big barrier out at the mouth of Ascension Bay. And the wind direction and the wind velocity against that reef, which acts almost like a dam, has more of an effect on the water level inside the bay than the lunar cycles do or the tide cycles do. So we'll have situations where we might have a north wind for a week and the water level may will drop. It'll stay that way for 4 or 5 days, and you won't see any appreciable difference in water height. In those situations, it's not really great fishing, because as the north wind persists, the fish tend to get spookier and move off the flat, and the water temperatures are dropped. And transversely, with a southeast wind, which we'll start to get in more and more of as the season progresses, it can stack a lot of water in over the top of the reef, fill the bay up, and the water becomes warmer. We get a lot of activity, but they're not as confined to specific flats. So we do a lot of moving around, and when we spot fish, we typically get out of the boat, walk an intercept route, and try to make a cast from standing on the beach. It seems like we spook a heck of a lot less fish that way.
Okay, for folks that aren't familiar with where you are, why don't you explain where in the world you are and also kind of explain that whole coast there, because there's good permit fishing from north of you all the way down to, like you said, down to Honduras. Can you kind of explain that whole area, like geographically as well?
Yeah, there's many mornings where I wake up and wonder where in the world I am. The really good habitat for permit, even though Cancun area has a lot of flats, but it seems like some of the activity commercially in the development up there has moved some of those tarpon and permit and bonefish to the north to Isla Contoy and Isla Holbosch and to the south. Unfortunately, when they move to the south, there isn't the habitat till you get down kind of close to Acamal and Puerto Aventuras. But the real decent habitat starts right in the Cancun area, which is a 1.3 million acre biosphere park, a UN World Heritage Site. Inside that park has Ascension Bay, and then the next bay to the south is Bahia del Espiritu Santo. There's a few good operations that are working down there as well. And between those two, we have over 160 miles of bay, of flats, where the average depth is probably 8-9 feet between two bodies of water. And there's, between the two bays, there's a vast area of mangrove system. And then to that, a river of grass that's very, very similar to the system that forms the Everglades, which was one of the reasons that the park was established in the first place. We've got snook and tarpon rearing ground, you know, and then we've got, of course, the bonefish and permit and multitudes of other different snapper species and things like that. But as you pick your way south from there, you get to Ishkalak and Laguna Bacalar and down into Chetumal Bay and Ambergris Key, and as you go south down through the Belize and Honduras areas. And all those areas are extremely rich in permit habitat and, of course, bonefish and tarpon as well. You know, the information that I typically collect is regarding permit.
Well, we have a question that came in on the Internet from Eric Edling in Minneapolis. Got to be cold there this time of year. I seem to end up in Cancun for a week with the family every year or two, and during those trips I usually get out with someone local and do some fishing. Is there any way to get down to Ascension Bay for a day trip? I hear it's 142 miles down Highway 307 and that it's a tough drive.
Well, is it possible? Yeah, it is possible. It's not as tough a drive as it used to be. It's 4-lane highway from all the way to just a few miles north of Tulum, and at Tulum is where you turn off the highway on the Boca Pila Road. And I'm actually sitting here looking at the Boca Pila Road sign, and then you drive 36 miles down the dirt road that gets to Punta Allen, and it takes about 2.5 hours, and it's about 110 miles. It's doable, but what I would recommend is if you want to do it, you should come down, fish a day, spend the night, fish a half day the next day, and then drive yourself home. And, you know, try to get as much as you can out of a day trip. There's some decent places to stay in town that are affordable. There's a lot of good places to eat, and there's several good guides that you can hire on a couple of days' notice.
Good, good. Well, that sounds like a plan. Well, we need to take a short break here, but when we return, we'll be talking more with Dick about fly fishing tactics for permit. Flats Time Charters is your sponsor for this segment of the show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dick Cameron about permit on the fly in Yucatan's Ascension Bay. If you'd like to ask Dick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll answer as many of the questions we receive on the show tonight as possible. Well, Dick, let's just take a minute and tell us a little bit about your lodge and the services you offer down there.
Well, we're a 12-guest facility right in the heart of the Little Lobster Fishing Village of Punta Allen, and we're basically an all-inclusive sort of an operation for a week stay, or actually we'll do stays of less than a week, but in our week-long stays, we'll pick you up at the airport, we bring you down, your meals are included, we have a happy hour that we host. Our fishing program, we have a one-to-one client-to-guide ratio, which is kind of unique, and it's really lends itself well to permit fishing, particularly the way that we do it. If you have two anglers and two guides in a boat, we're using the 23-foot Panga-style flats boats with the 40-horse ecological motors on them, and we can get in very skinny water. But when we spot a school of permit and the guy that's up fishing is able to get out of the boat with his guide, and the other guide and other client are able to take that boat back out of contention and out of the spooking zone for the permit, it just changes the dynamic of your whole fishing experience. It's worked out well for us. There's a lot of other very successful fishing programs out there. That's just the way we do it. Our lodge is set up. We have air conditioning, wireless internet, and all six of our rooms are equipped with private bathrooms. Modern kitchen, great food, wonderful people. I guess that's about it.
Well, give us your website address so everybody can find you.
We're at www.palometaclub.com, and that's spelled PALOMETA club.com.
And you had said earlier when I talked to you in the day that you were expanding your operation. Now, before you talk about that, can a person also fish for tarpon or bonefish or snook in Ascension Bay?
We can. As a matter of fact, the snook fishing has been really good the last couple weeks, and it usually is through December and January and into February. It's to get anglers that want to concentrate on it. Ordinarily, we get people that come down specifically looking for the permit, and they don't venture out for other things. But the snook fishing here is probably even stronger than the tarpon fishing that we have as far as the number of fish that you get and the quality of fish that you get. We had a guest get one that was 29 pounds a year ago December, which is a good fish anywhere you go. Our tarpon fishing is more along the lines of the baby tarpon. It's the 5 to 15-pound tarpon, but there's such a blast on an 8-weight, and they do all the things that the big ones do. It's a pretty good experience as well.
And then you said you were doing, what's your new expansion? You want to talk about that?
Yeah, we've brought a couple of 32-foot center console boats over from South Florida. My old friend Rob Fordyce that was mentioned in the bio, we're offering offshore light tackle and fly fishing opportunities with either bait and switch or just on patch reefs and pinnacles and stuff just on the other side of the reef. And it's a very old, tried and true kind of South Florida, Florida Keys tactic, but it's the first time that this sort of thing has been introduced to this area. And we got over here on February 1st, and we've been test fishing it. Our first group of clients were this week. The response we got from them was phenomenal. We got like 5 species of groupers, 10 species of snappers, kingfish, sierra, mackerel. And, you know, once you get things all active up and up on the surface, you know, you dump a fly into that sort of situation, and it gets pretty sporty.
So is that something a person could enjoy, both permit fishing and the blue water fishing in one trip?
Yes, it is, and it's one of the reasons that we're so excited about this particular product is because I can't think of another facility or an area that can provide world-class inshore flats fishing for permit, tarpon, snook, and bonefish, and then the very next day be able to go offshore and fish an area of a reef that is virtually untouched for another world-class experience on some more non-typical species. We're hoping that as the water temperatures warm up, we'll get some of the more known game fish to come in, like Dorado and Wahoo and some of the billfish. But right now, we're just really enjoying what we're finding right now.
Yeah, that sounds great. Sounds like quite the experience. Thanks for sharing that about your lodge and your fishing operation. That's great. We've got a question here. I had one lined up talking about, you know, what the last hurricane did to the fishery down there. And then we just got one in. Doesn't say who it's from, but he says he was in Ascension Bay recently. Water seems to be a little bit different color from the recent hurricane. Has this had any effect on the fishery at all? I mean, we all heard about the hurricane and almost went right through your place, I take it.
Well, it actually went 65 miles south of us, more through, right through Ishkalak and Mahwal and that area down there, Puerto Maya, where the cruise ship terminal was, took the biggest brunt of it. I was down here about 3 weeks after Dean passed through, and the damage was largely superficial, and our building looked like it was completely untouched except for all the little tips of the palm fronds that were stuck into the plywood that we had covering the windows. But in Wilma, in the 2 years or so before that, there was a lot more damage to the reef itself, where there were chunks of coral that had rolled up on the beach, and the water was noticeably changed, and the lobstermen lost a lot of their tramp, as they call them, basically their artificial habitat that they used to catch the lobsters in. But in Dean, we didn't have anywhere near that amount of aquatic disturbance. So, you know, to address the gentleman's question regarding the watercolor, this bay cleans up so quickly anyway that it was probably more of a product of a windstorm that he had more closer to his visit than the hurricane itself.
Okay. But it hasn't put off the fishing or put on the fishing per se? Things are just basically normal since the hurricane?
Things are pretty normal. There's been some channel changes, a couple of changes in direction in some of the bigger channels that kind of lace through the middle or the heart of the bay, but those really don't affect what we're doing. And from the stories I've heard from not just from our guides and clients, but from other people in the town, there's quite a bit of activity from both permit and bonefish. So I don't really think that Dean had much to do with us at all. I feel sad for the guys south of us, but I think they'll come back pretty quickly as well.
Okay. I've got a question here from Andy Stilitano in Palo Verdes, California. He wants to know, what's the best time of year to fish that coast?
Well, like I said earlier, these are resident fish, and they're not going anywhere. The best time to come is when you've got the least likelihood of getting some sort of bad weather anomaly. So typically, you know, any time after late February, your likelihood of having a cold front come down from your guys' area and affect our weather down here, those likelihoods get more and more slim. And then the water temps come up and all that stuff. But to pick one month out of the year is very, very difficult because, like I said earlier, I could go back through my logbook and find a great week in December. I can find a great week in January. And it was all something that was tied to weather. So if I had to put it in a window, and this isn't going to be very specific, I would say from 1st of March to the middle of June.
Would be the best season, yeah.
You can fish all year round, just like you could in the Keys. But moving away from the winter months and getting away from the likelihood of a cold front coming down is, you know, going to be your best bet.
Now, as far as temperature goes down there, it's, what, within 20 degrees pretty much most of the year?
It really is, but what you start having happen as the days get longer and we get closer to spring and then into summer is right now we're getting really nice cooling periods in the nighttime. So it'll drop down to 69 to 72 in the night times. When we get to May and June, there won't be that difference in the daytime temperatures and the nighttime temperatures. It just stays really warm, which is why we got to have AC in the building.
Let's talk about equipment. Again, Andy Stilitano, Palo Verdes, wants to know what kind of rod length, what weight is best for permit?
Basically, 8, 9, and 10, I'll just describe what I do. And I like a very fast action rod, and there's, of course, several good companies that are making a premium saltwater rod. Sage is making a great one. The guys at Winston have a really good product. The Scott is a good one. Any fast action rod that you feel comfortable throwing in a 9 foot length. And if you're going out specifically for a permit and you take your 8, your 9, and your 10, and you set your 9 up with your lighter fly, your 8 with the lightest fly, 9 with the medium fly, and your 10 with your heaviest, you're going to be set for all conditions you may encounter during the course of the day. With a floating line, leader lengths are 10 to 12 feet, and I typically don't go down lighter than 12 to 15 on my tippet.
Okay. I think you kind of broke up there before when you said the length of rod. Was it 9 foot? Is that what you said?
9 foot.
Okay.
9 foot.
Okay. Okay. Now, the leader, do you just use a straight leader? Is it a tapered leader?
Tapered leader. I like to build my leaders. You know, there's a lot of great products that come right out of the off the shelves, but I like to build my leaders with, you know, my butt section being two-thirds the length of overall leader, and on the 8, I'll use a 30-pound butt section. On the 9 and the 10, it'll be 40, and then taper down to where, in just two steps, to where I get to 15 at the end.
Okay, okay. And what was the length of the leader again?
10 to 12 feet overall.
10 to 12 feet, okay, okay. Question from Frank in D.C., British Columbia, Lanceville, British Columbia. And he says, my saltwater salmon tackle is probably fine for bonefish, 8 weight to 200 yards backing and so forth. Will that work for permit? I think he just said that an 8 weight would be fine on the light end, right?
Yeah, it would.
And so, and then he's got a 10 weight. So a lot of people that are set up for salmon fishing are probably set up, other than changing out the line, pretty well set up for permit then.
They are. They just want to be careful that if they've got a reel that's not specifically or not, you know, designed to take some sort of saltwater abuse, that, you know, maybe they want to look at a new reel, or if not, just be very, very careful when they're down here that it's rinsed and maintained properly after they leave.
Now, here's another question. A second part of Frank's question was, if I travel to Ascension Bay, do guides have tackle for permit, or is it best to bring your own?
Well, it's always best to bring your own, particularly when you're traveling, you know, this far from home. In the region here, I don't know of any guides that are just strictly a guide that have an acceptable assortment of tackle for to use.
Okay.
We do at the club have things for people to use and even to rent, but it's very, very rare in this area that if you just go into a town like Punta Allen or Ishkalak or Isla Hobos, that you're going to find a guide that is set up like you would find a guy in Florida that's got all the rods and reels and flies that you need. It isn't the case in this area.
But, for instance, coming to your lodge, if a guy brought his own stuff but broke his rod, you wouldn't be down and out then.
No, we have all that, and we have, even if the guys show up and they've got a need for something heavier than they brought, we've got plenty of stuff to fill a gap in your arsenal.
Okay, great. We had a question from Dick Park in Williston, Vermont. He wants to know about floating versus intermediate sink, or you want to explain what lines you use?
Well, I like a floating line, I would say, 99% of the time. The area down here, it doesn't lend itself well for a sink or even an intermediate. And the reason for that is we don't have enough deep water that we fish. You know, if you're fishing closer to the reef, which we don't do that often, there might be a time and an opportunity to change out to an IM line or even a full sink. But what we do most of the time, because our flies are so heavily weighted, is we just run a straight floating line. And if we've got issues with water depth, we might lengthen the leader a little bit. But the flies are heavy enough weighted that we don't have to worry about weighting them with a fly line.
Okay. Okay. What about backing? The permit run a lot? Do you need a lot of backing, or what do you recommend there?
A permit does run a lot, and very similarly to bonefish, it'll take a big first run. But unlike a bonefish, it doesn't just come right back in after that first run. And the equation that we found to be true for fighting a permit is about a minute a pound. So if you hook into a 20-pounder, you could be looking at a 20- to 25-minute fight. A lot of that is going to be done on your backing. So even though you might not need a 300 yards of backing, you certainly need 150 to 200, and you need something that's really good quality that you can trust. And, of course, your connection between fly line and backing should be very, very secure.
Well, we talked about rods, reels, and fly line here, and that you should bring your own. What about flies themselves? We got a question from John in Warrington, Virginia. He says he's booked to come down in late May for 4 days of fishing. Are there well-stocked fly shops in Punta Allen with flies, line, and other equipment? You had said that the rods were in short supply, but what about flies? Is that something you should bring yourself as well?
There isn't a fly shop in the region. There's not even one in Cancun.
Yeah.
Cancun has a million people, and there's not even a fly shop. No, you really need to bring that stuff with you. There's a lot of great outlets for saltwater flies, and, of course, there's flies out there that are tied and designed to catch fish, and there's others that are tied and designed to catch anglers. If you stick to the more basic tried-and-true patterns, Dell's Merkin is still a great one. The raghead-type crab flies, the Jan's Crab or the Joe's ATC, any one of those raghead types are a good fly. The Velcro flies are good. And then any of the larger shrimp imitations, you know, you should have a selection of all that stuff, and the smallest hook you should tie stuff on is a 2, and then go up to maybe even a 1-aught, and you should have them weighted from medium all the way up to very heavy in all the various patterns that you bring. At most of the local fly shops around the country, if they haven't been here, they know someone that has been, and they should have a decent recommendation for you.
Okay, well, we'll continue talking about flies here when we return, and we'll dig into that a little bit deeper. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familytyes.com, that's familytyes.com, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dick Cameron about Permit on the Fly in Yucatan's Ascension Bay. If you'd like to ask Dick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Before we get back to flies, Dick, I wanted to ask you, for people that have not been to the tropics fishing, what other things as far as equipment should you bring down in the way of clothing, footwear, sunglasses, that kind of thing?
Well, first of all, sunscreen, and lots of it. Even though if you come from a sunny climate, you know, we're at latitude 19 here, and it's pretty intense. If you're real sun-sensitive, you can't beat clothing. The sun gloves are a good product to have. A good long-sleeve shirt that's got at least an sun protection factor of 30. Long-sleeve pants, we kind of get a mixed group of clients that wear them and some that wear shorts. The zip-off ones seem to be the most popular. I don't like the long pants when I'm wading because they seem to bog you down. But footwear is another very important thing. We do so much of our fishing outside of the boat that if you bang up a foot in the first 2-year trip, your trip's going to be ruined. You don't need a big, heavy-duty flats boot like a mall walker or something like that. An aqua sock or some of the more technical wading sandals are all that you need. The flats that we have here are sandy and got some crushed shells and a little bit of rock on them. You know, if you go further south from here down into Honduras or Belize, or you go over to the Bahamas, you're going to need a stouter shoe. But for this area, just a good sandal or Nike Aqua Sock, or the Tiva makes a pair of dive booties are even good enough.
Yeah, the dive booties with the soles are kind of nice for a lot of different things. But
they are. They zip on and off so quickly, so you can dump the sand out of them if you get any on in one of your wades, and they work really well. Another thing that a lot of people neglect to bring is a good boat bag. You know, even though our boats are nice and big and spacious, no boat that I know of is overly dry riding, particularly if you got a little chop in a bay crossing. And, you know, everybody's got a digital camera these days, and not all of them are waterproof. So, you know, you got binoculars and things like that. Spend a little money, get a good waterproof zip-up boat bag that you can get all your stuff in. And you want a nice, lightweight rain jacket that you can wear on your crossings. And we do get cool now and then, but salt water off you. And the sunglasses, there's so many good glasses out, so many good lenses out right now, but the amber shade seems to be the best. And Action Optics got a copper color. Costa Del Mar's got a vermilion. Keenan's got this really nice CR39 color that seems to penetrate real well here. But any of the major manufacturers have a good copper, amberish sort of lens that's great for the flats.
One tip I think it was Brian O'Keefe gave us was, he says he always brings 2 pair of sunglasses, one for riding in the boat and one for fishing, because he was always cleaning his glasses after a boat ride, and sometimes, you know, that was a hassle where he could just switch off back and forth. So that might be a tip for some folks.
It is a good tip, and one of those, you should have them in 2 different shades, and if you got a bright sunny day, you know, wear the one that you don't think you're going to have as your full time. But if you've got a light colored shade, a yellow or one of the lighter ambers, you know, on an overcast day, it can really make a difference in what you can see on that day.
Well, good. Well, let's talk more about food and flies. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned some of the, you know, I think you were talking mainly about crabs, but let's talk about what primary food source for the permit are, and then more about flies. In fact, Frank Kazell from Lanceville, British Columbia again, wanted to know which flies to tie and if there was a recommended pattern and book that you could recommend as well.
As far as what flies to tie, like I said earlier, the Velcros really are about the easiest and a very good universal pattern for down here. You can tie them small, the bonefish enjoy them as well. And you can get them up to the 1-inch Velcro coin, and you could tie a great big one on a number one or one-aught hook and weight that pretty heavy. The Wapsie makes a really nice product called a fly tail that you can use for the pinchers on those, on that particular pattern. Then you can just use the regular Wapsie silly legs for the legs. I'm not sure of a book that illustrates that pattern really well, but I'm sure if you go online, you could probably pull up a Velcro fly pattern. The raghead fly that I mentioned earlier is a much more labor-intensive fly and is basically a yarn fly, but got a barge cement body, and you press the chopped-up yarn fiber into it to make more of a firm crab-looking body than, say, a Dell's Merkin. You know, the shrimp patterns, you know, any one of the saltwater fly-tying books is going to give you a plethora of shrimp patterns. And the ones that are most effective in this area are ones that more mimic a baby lobster, which is going to be a reddish-tan color. Its overall length is going to be anywhere from 1.5 inches to 2.5 inches long, depending on the time of year. And it has a long antenna sort of system and, of course, no pinchers because we have the Caribbean spiny lobster here.
Okay. Well, one book that I've got in my hands right now is Jack Sampson's book on fly fishing for a permit. He does have some color photographs of some of the flies in there and some recipes, not instructions, but does identify some of those. And the Velcro and the ragheads, those were all simulating crabs, right?
They are.
That's the primary food source?
It is the primary food source here, crab and shrimp. But they do eat a lot of baby conch, and there's a clam here that at its full growth is not much larger than your fingernail, but it's pretty hard to tie a baby conch fly. So we haven't spent a lot of time replicating that one, but the crab and shrimp patterns seem to work as well as, you know, let me qualify that, they work as well as anything works on a permit. And fortunately, in the area and on my staff, I've got several of my guys that are very avid tiers. And they're also lobstermen, so they'll harvest some of the little crustaceans that they find in their area and tie up crab patterns that replicate the colors of these small crab that we have in the area. So if you bring a crab that's kind of neutral in its configurement when you leave the United States and enough pins to spot it up or stripe it up when you get here, you'd probably be in good shape. Reddish rust colored pins, blue and brown and black.
Okay, good tip. You talked about three different rods, 8, 9, and 10 before, with different weight flies on them. How do you sort those out in your tackle box or your fly boxes? I mean, is there a way you code them or anything?
If you've got a particular hook size that you can recognize as being different, just like you tie your lighter ones on a 2 and your heavier ones on a 1 and or your medium ones on a 1 and your heaviest ones on a 1-aught, you should be able to tell them all apart pretty well.
So just by hook size, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and that also helps the weight of them quite a bit without having to vary, you know, you don't have to go ginormous on your dumbbell eyes for your heaviest flies because your hook weight's also helping add to the overall weight of the fly.
Well, and I like your idea about the different rods because as you go up in weight on the fly, then you got a heavier stick to throw it with, right?
Yeah, and it's like any near coastal fishery, anywhere you go in the world, you've always got wind to deal with. And, you know, not everybody practices for a month before they come down here, and having a little extra meat on the rod to turn that fly over doesn't hurt.
Well, a question from Frank in British Columbia again. He gave us quite a few questions here. Thanks, Frank. Is the pattern more important, or is the presentation and location more important when you're casting to the permit?
Actually, the fish is the most important. I'll qualify that statement. I'd rather make the worst cast to the best fish than the best cast to the worst fish. If you've got a hungry fish, he's going to make up for a bad cast or a bad presentation. you can make 150 perfect casts in the right spot to a fish that just isn't hungry and it doesn't get it done. There's so many things that has to come together to get that permit to eat your fly and for you to get him to hand. It's hard to break it down to just presentation and just pattern. Like I said a second ago, I think the fish is the most important thing, but you know, you don't know which is the one that's hungriest, so you got to keep trying.
So when a fish is hungry and he's on the take, then is he basically very aggressive and eating about anything in his path?
You know, unfortunately, when permit is aggressively feeding, we don't know exactly what he's aggressively feeding on. It could be one of those situations where they're eating those baby conch shells and we're throwing a crab pattern at it. They're not just eating anything in their path. They're eating something very specific. So you got to get to where you make enough shots, and if you generate some interest and to get a follow, if at least if you get a fish to follow but he doesn't take, then you can start changing flies and hopefully have enough other opportunities to get him to eat something that you do have. But the best situation, you get several fish feeding in there and a little bit of competition is generated and you've got two or more fish going at that same fly, and then it seems to matter less if it's specifically what they were feeding on before you got there.
Okay, okay. One last question on flies. A question from Ed Hewden in Byfield, Massachusetts. Says, do you believe that permit can smell flies that were tied with head cement? Does that make a difference?
Well, I think they can smell everything. I mean, they're a double-nostriled creature. So I think that their olfactory system is incredibly refined, but who knows if that head cement or a barge cement or some other sort of ingredient got in that fly, if it puts them off. I couldn't really tell you if it turns off or...
Do you use head cement on your flies?
No, I use super glue.
Super glue, okay.
Super glue seems to be, it seems to be a little bit more inert.
Okay,
but we have
okay.
Anglers that come down here that do use head cement, and they're very successful. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, the newness of the fly or how long it's been since you tied it. Those fumes do escape over a certain amount of time. That's a good question. It's a really good question.
Yeah, hard to test, I think, too.
Like, yeah.
After a few casts, it might not make a difference, you know. But
I had a group of anglers that came down here, and they were using scents. There were two of them that were using scents and the two of them that weren't, which I'm opposed to. I'll be on record as saying that right now. But the guys with the unscented flies did better than the ones that the guys artificially scented. So who's to say?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about out there on the hunt here. We've got a lot of flats that we're usually in, like you said, somewhere between, what, 3 and 10 feet or so, depending on the area you're in.
Yeah.
And are you looking for schools of fish, or are you looking for single fish? Is it pretty much sight fishing, or is it all sight fishing?
It's all sight fishing. Every bit of it is sight fishing. To answer your question, whether we're looking for solos or schools, the answer is yes. We're looking for solos and schools.
Whatever comes around, okay?
Yeah. You know, as we get later in the year, we'll start seeing the fish school up a little bit more. But it's not unusual down here to encounter schools of 200 or 300 permit together. It's not unusual.
Well, now, as opposed to, like, when you've got a shot at a school of tarpon, you might get one, maybe two shots at that school, and then it's all over with. What about a school of permit? Do you get many shots at that school?
Yeah, you can. The problem when you get a large school of permit, they've got a lot of things that are following them around. You get a lot of other things mixed in it, jacks, bonefish, and things like that are much more aggressive feeders than a permit is. So when you start sneaking a fly in close enough to get a permit to take, more often than not, you'll get a jack or a bonefish that will hit it, even if a permit's pursuing it. So to answer your question, yes, you get a lot of shots at that school of permit. Unfortunately, it ends up being a pretty frustrating deal. Better chances are with smaller schools of, like, say, 6 to 20 permit, where they haven't generated so much commotion that they've drawn other species over to them.
Okay, okay. Now, before you had mentioned fishing from a boat or wading, and it sounded like you preferred the wading method. Can you kind of explain the two approaches and maybe the challenges of each?
Well, they both have their merit, of course. The The advantage to casting from a boat is you're on an elevated casting platform, so you've got better visibility into the water, and you know you can track changes of direction with the fish easier than if you're in the water. The disadvantage to being in the boat is the boat has quite a presence. It has a big shadow that it creates on the bottom, and it probably has, you know, waves hitting against the side, making, you know, hull slap sort of noises, and which puts you at a disadvantage. When you're in the water, even if you're moving along at as high a rate of speed as you can push in waist deep water and kicking up mud and stuff behind you, it doesn't seem to spook fish. It doesn't seem to spook permit, and you can get a lot closer. The disadvantage is it's more difficult for you to see them when you're in the water. But down here, you have a guide with you. You can get so much closer to the fish when you're on foot that it seems to make up for that.
Okay. Well, what are some of the tips you can give us? Well, before I get into that, let me take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about spotting the fish themselves and some tips about that.
Okay, great.
Have you ever dreamed about classic action bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com for more information. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dick Cameron about permit fishing in Yucatan's Ascension Bay. If you'd like to ask Dick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, folks, I want to apologize for some of the communication problems we're having. Dick literally is under some palm tree down there in Mexico under a cell tower trying to get the best connection he has, and that literally is the best connection we can get down to the area he's in. So apologize for some of the breakups, and just bear with us, and we'll try to repeat the sections that we lose out on. So, okay, Dick, back to the spotting of permit. What tips can you give for looking at fish? I know you said the guides down there are incredible with their eyesight, but what can we, as new to this whole environment, what tips can you give us in spotting fish?
Well, the best thing is to forget about trying to spot an entire fish. You know, and that's what most of us do is, you know, we try to identify the entire picture of a permit or a bonefish or a tarpon. But what you're looking for is some telltale signs. Like with a permit, it's two diagonal black lines, one indicating its dorsal fin and one indicating its tail. And depending on the distance of those apart, you can kind of judge the rough size of the fish. But that's what you're looking for. You know, when fish are tailing up or pushing water, it's easy for all of us. It's when they're down a little bit in the water column and not moving very fast that it makes them difficult to see.
And they're like bonefish in that they have that mirrored side, correct?
Oh, they're just shiny as a new dollar.
And would you say they're harder to spot than a bonefish or easier?
It depends on the bottom. I think most times that they're easier just because they're a bigger presence anyway, and a lot of times they're moving across a sandy bottom, and they zigzag back and forth in their quest for food. So you see those two diagonal black lines that I just described. You see those changing back and forth, and even if you can't see the whole body of the fish, you know, that kind of alerts you that there's something out there that you should pay more attention to, and that's about the best way I can describe it.
Okay. Now, Ted Hasselbring in Nashville, Tennessee wants to know how far you have to be able to cast with accuracy for a permit.
Well, we like our anglers to be able to throw 150 feet straight into a 20-knot headwind.
Yeah, but, that's what you'd like. You don't get that too often.
No, but really, if you can throw, and a good practice for this is if you've got a golf course near home or a field, and if you can put some, you know, half a dozen rings, hula hoop size rings around you in a complete 360-degree circle around you, and you stand in the middle 30 or 40 feet away from those, and you can hit every one of those in any wind state, you're plenty good enough to be here. And really, our average casting distance is about 30, 40 feet.
But that can be a challenge in the wind, even.
It can be, but, you know, we work very, very hard at getting you set up to where you're not having to punch straight up wind, or you're not having it completely smashing your back cast either.
Yeah, yeah. One of the questions that came in while we were talking about presentation is from Jack in Richmond, Vermont. He said he's tried a lot of Velcro crab patterns, and they're all beige sand color. Should I dye some of them more olive green for different sunlight conditions?
Yes, olive green is not a particularly great color for here, but it is a particularly good color for the Keys and some of the areas that have more turtle grass. We don't have a lot of turtle grass in the two bays that we work here. It is generally a good color to have some in olive and even some darker shades of green. Even just the white Velcro tabs and some of the good fly marking pens that are out there now, you can mark them once you get to a place.
And the colors, again, you said were?
Reds. There's a kind of a rust-colored red that's really popular, and then the blue, like a blue crab blue, and brown and black.
Okay. I got a couple questions. Oddly enough, they're very similar. One from John and one from Derek. Derek's in Richmond, British Columbia. They're both asking about if you've got one rod and you have an opportunity between bones and a permit, you know, should you, well, I guess Derek asked, you know, would you cast your bonefish fly to a permit and hope for the best if you get a shot at one? Is that reasonable?
You take what opportunity presents itself. You've only got one shot. You got a better chance even with your bonefish fly than putting nothing in the water. So always take that shot.
Or trying to tie on something else. Yeah, that was his question. So you're not going to have time to tie anything else on.
No, but most of the time, if you're out wading the flat, specifically bone fishing, you're in a shallower flat, and you're gonna get some warning. It's not gonna happen to you so quickly, because a permit's gonna come on you, pushing a lot of water or tailing out in front of you. And there's two flies that I carry in my bonefish fly box all the time, and one is a quan, because it's a great universal fly for both bonefish and permit, and the other one is an epoxy shrimp, which. And both of those are bigger than my normal bonefish selection. And, you know, you'll have enough time to throw one of those two on if a permit comes up on the bonefish flats.
Okay. But generally, you're making some kind of transition in water depth probably between the two species when you're, I mean, if you're targeting bonefish, you're probably in one type of water and you're a deeper water, I guess, for permit then.
Yeah, exactly. The bonefish flats that we have here, which we have a lot of clients that do this, that two guys, you know, one guy's out on the edge in the boat pulling along the edge of the flat looking for permit, and the other guy's up on the flats with his guide walking it fishing bonefish. So they're not that far apart, but permit are generally in deeper water. It is not unusual to have a permit cross across your bonefish flat.
Okay.
When you're just out walking for bones.
And so if he comes by, you take your shot, and you don't care what
take
you got
your
on.
Shot. He's coming up on that flat to eat whatever the bonefish are probably eating, so you got a better chance of throwing that out in front of him than you do nothing. That's for sure.
Okay. Here's a question from Jim Mossor in West Virginia. As permit get closer in their methodic search for crabs, how do you get his attention? And after his close inspection, what retrieve will best get a pickup instead of a refusal?
Well, that's kind of a tough question, because there's nothing that works every time for permit. Let me qualify this answer before I even say it. Nothing works every time for permit, no matter what. But what we like to do here is once we cast the fly in front of the permit and let it sink to what we think is to the bottom or close to bottom depth, we move it in a long, slow strip. And that does two things. It'll draw attention to the fly, because whatever you've tied it with, the rubber legs or silly legs or whatever, will have some movement as you strip it slowly across the bottom. And it keeps you in contact with that fly, you know, that you don't get a belly in the line from the current or something like that. That's one of the other problems with permit, is they can pick up a fly and spit it back out so quickly that if you don't have good contact with the fly, you won't even feel it. So the strip or the cast and retrieve method that we do is cast it into what we believe the sight window to be, let it sink as close to the bottom, and then move it in a long, slow strip across the bottom and maintaining constant contact with the fly and your hand in constant contact with the fly line.
Okay, a couple clarifications there. When you say a long strip, what is long to you?
From your first stripping guide up on the rod all the way back to your hip.
Oh,
in a long continuous motion all the way back to your hip. And this is the tricky part. What happens is a lot of people try to get in that long, slow rhythm, and then they'll take almost equally as long reaching back up to that stripper guide to get another handful of line. Once you get to the full length of your strip and never go past your hip because you won't have room to strip set if he does pick it up. Once you get back that far, then quickly as you can, reach up and get contact with the fly line again up by your stripper guide and then pull it all the way through.
Yeah, I never really thought of that as, you know, if you're outstretched all the way behind you and then that's when they hit, you're in trouble. Right?
You're really done.
Yeah.
You pull back a beautifully smashed crab fly.
Yeah. Now, the other question was, you said the sight window, I think you described it, of the fish. I see a permit out there and he's feeding. How far ahead of him do I cast and to allow for, and I guess that depends on depth too, doesn't it?
It does depend on depth, and it depends on what kind of activity the permit's involved in. And typically you want it close unless he's just moving fast. And you do get a lot of cruising fish is what we call them. And they're just fish that really aren't actively involved in feeding, but they're not spooked. They're not running, but they're just moving at a pretty good clip from one area to the next. It's the lowest percentage chance that you're going to get in casting to a permit just because they're not lit up by the activity of feeding. And they're moving at such a pace that it's tough to get a fly in front of them and down to where they'll see it. But occasionally you do, and a lot of times you want to cast very, very close to that fish's head.
When you say very close, are we talking a foot or two or 3 feet or 5 feet?
Yeah, a foot.
A foot, okay.
Yeah.
On top of them. And that doesn't scare them off, the splash or anything.
It can. But you have such a low chance of getting that fish to see your fly anyway that you've got to put it right in there. You know, that's a 1 in 50 chance that fish is even going to turn and look at your fly. So if that's the only shot you got to just tuck it right in on his head. Sandy Moret over in Florida, his theory for those type of fish is just to try to hit him in the tail, to just try to actually hit him, and he's had him turn and eat the fly. So,
wake up, buddy, huh? Here
yeah,
I am.
He's a you know, way better caster than I am. He can probably do that where he can hit him in the tail consistently, but it's a low percentage chance anyway, so tuck it in there, take your chance, and go. But if you got a fish that, or several fish even, that are feeding and moving, what they do is they'll feed a spot and then they'll zigzag back and forth, and anticipating, you know, which way they're going to zig or zag is a very difficult thing. You know, if you can catch them when they're tailed up and you can get it, you know, right on their dinner plate, you got a good opportunity. But if they're moving from one spot to the next, if you get it 4 or 5 feet out in front of them and let it drop because they're already looking down, they're looking for the next thing to eat, and then there's a real good chance that they're going to follow it to the bottom. If you get two or more of them to follow it to the bottom, then things really get exciting. But, you know, if you talk to any experienced permit angler, they've had dozens and dozens of instances where they've got their nail knot completely in the tip top of their rod before the permit turns away. And you think at every turn that they're going to eat it, but they just, at the very last,
just
away.
Don't. Well, let's say that we do get one here.
Okay.
You said before a strip strike, is that how you set the hook? Tell us once you get the take what you do.
The strip strike is, you know, it's pretty universal in saltwater, and that's exactly what you do with a permit. And you don't have to rip them like you do with a tarpon because their mouth isn't that hard. They've got a big set of very rubbery lips, and if they've got it back in their cruncher, there's a chance that you might yank it completely out and not hook anything on the way out if you if you pull too hard, but you want to strip and then keep it firm and either back up or strip line in until he changes direction and starts going the other direction to help you clear the line. And once the line's cleared, once you have them on the reel, then what I typically do is give them a couple more little sets with the rod just to make sure that we're on the same page, and then it's off to the races.
Okay. And then what's the fight like with a permit? What can you expect, and what are some tips you can give us on fighting the fish?
Even the small ones, they never give up. That's the coolest thing about this fish. They're not overly fast. They don't make these greyhounding runs, but it's just a constant tussle from the time that you hook them to the time that you land them. But the coolest thing about them is once you do land them, they go completely docile. They're the easiest fish I've ever taken a picture of. It's just wild. And then once you release them, they're off again. But they're a very photogenic customer at that point.
Well, that always was something that I wondered about, because you see these nice pictures, and you look at the fish and you think, gosh, that would be a hard fish to hold potentially. I mean, just by the shape of it and so forth.
They're not in that regard. They've got a couple good handles on them, and especially the wrist of the tail is real nice and firm. But, you know, it's like anything. When you're fighting those things, you want to keep the rod tip low. You want to fight them in the lower third of the rod, and you want to try to control their head. You want to keep the line down their side as much as possible and make them do what you want them to do. With the bigger fish, that's not always easy in the first half of the fight, but sooner or later you can get control of their head and get them in.
Now, do mangroves present an issue in the area that you fish as far as getting, do they run into the mangroves or do they go out deep?
Very rarely do mangroves present an issue. What becomes more of an issue is a sea fan or a rock, because we have a lot of limestone, sandstone inside the bay, even though the coral is out further, but it's more the, not so much mangroves, but sea fans.
Okay. And usually are they, when you land the fish, are you handling them with your hands rather than a net? Do you stay away from nets? Or?
Yeah, we don't use any nets at all.
Okay.
And we try to just, like I said a second ago, just a wrist of the tail and just a little bit of support under the pec fins to get some pictures, and then we get them back in the water. They're an extremely hardy fish, though. Extremely hardy. If you keep them in the water, you can take a dozen photos if you want to between dips.
Okay. Any problem with releasing them with regards to sharks?
No, not really. We've lost a few. 2 weeks ago, we actually lost one, but it was during the fight that the shark actually took the tail off one in the last part of the fight, and that was pretty tough. But typically in the release, we don't. You know, there's enough between the guides and everybody, there's enough people around to where you can see where the sharks are, if there are any, and keep it from getting eaten.
Okay. A couple last questions, and this is about trip planning, and then we have to wrap things up here rather quickly. So one of the questions was from Jay in the Netherlands. Is it possible to do a budget trip to the Yucatan? If so, how?
Yeah, it is possible. There's several locations down here that do have either small hotels, and the little town, that particularly the town that we're in, has got a couple smaller operations that just you can get a decent room and you can find meals throughout town and get a decent guide, you know, on a budget trip. It can be done.
Okay. Is that those hotels and so forth, are those accessible by the internet, or is that something you come to town and you just kind of poke around with, or?
Both, you know, and okay. the lodging is going to be an easier thing to secure before you leave the Netherlands, but it's going to be really difficult to secure a guide before you get down here, because they're, you know, these guys don't have websites, their, you know, communications is a little bit tough, and it's probably the same if you wanted to try to do a budget trip in Belize or Honduras as well. It's just tough to nail down that guide portion of your trip until you get here.
And then you just have to ask around, basically, and try to find someone, right?
Yeah, you do. And okay. Most of these little towns have their favorite guy that they want to push people to anyway, so.
And what, just for people's interest, what is the price range down there for trips? Or, I don't know, what's average? Is it a 5-day or 7-day trip that you guys do?
We do a 7-day trip, and Ours is $3,200 for a week, and like I said, it's pretty much all inclusive. And I think you can go up and down that scale. I know that there's some operations around here that are considerably more than us, and some that are considerably less. You basically you just need to figure out, what you want in your accommodations and in your comfort level with what's being provided. We feel pretty good about our staff and our guides and our fishing program, as well as our lodging and food and beverage service. I think we're right perfectly where we need to be, but there are less expensive places that are still a good experience, and then there's more expensive for,
Sure. Yeah.
That's the route you want to go.
Great. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and we need to wrap things up here. Stick with us, though, folks. We're going to give away a few gifts here, 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and a $20 gift certificate from Front Range Anglers. So stick with us. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They also provide both walk and wade and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas South Platte and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to the Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Well, just a quick reminder to everybody, before you leave the website tonight, please let us know what you thought of the show. You'll find a link on our homepage, the section for Dick's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that, leave your comments. We'd sure appreciate those. Well, now it's time to give away some prizes, and the first one we're going to give away is a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and to be involved in this drawing, you have to have registered. It's a little too late now, but next time make sure you're in the registration database so that you can have a chance at a lot of these great gifts we have. So that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, I'm going to pick our database, see what we come up here, and we've got Scott, and it's Gladio, it looks like, in Alaska. So, Scott, congratulations. You got that 3-year membership, and if you already have one, then we can extend it for you. And enjoy. It's always a great gift to be part of the Federation of Fly Fishers. And then the next one, and by the way, their website is fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. The next gift is a 1-year membership to Fly Fusion Magazine. Their website is flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. They're out of Calgary, Canada, and they have a great magazine on fly fishing. And our winner there is Tom Zamina in Ohio. So congratulations, Tom, on that gift tonight. Well, now it's time to give away a $20 gift certificate, and we do that by asking a question, and then you can submit your answers on our webpage, on the front homepage there, in that text box, just the same place you've been asking questions. And our question for tonight, and I'll let Dick decide what the correct answer is, and I'll make this easy. So you better be fast out there. I hope you guys are all ready. The question is, what is the most common food source for the permit? Most common food source for the permit. Okay, so Dick, I'm waiting here for somebody to respond, and then they'll win that $20 gift certificate if they get it right. Checking here and see if we get an answer.
This is going to be a reward for speed, not intellect.
Yeah, I know. Well, we don't have any speedy participants here tonight either. Here we got one. Jonathan Brantley, and his answer is crab. I think he got it right, didn't he?
I think he's pretty dang close, yeah.
See, I try to make it easy on you guys. Well, Jonathan, be sure and send me you can do this right in the same place you just answered the question. Be sure and send me your email address so I can communicate with you after the show to get your information. Put that in there and I'll grab it from there. Or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. You get that $20 gift certificate from Front Range Anglers in Boulder. Their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. mountrangeanglers.com. Well, Dick, we really appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. It was fun talking to you. I know we had some communication problems there, but that's what we get for trying to talk to a guy on the beach in the jungle under a palm tree, right?
Yeah, it's tough. I've had my feet up here the whole time, but it's been great. It was fun. There's so much still more to talk about, so you guys just going to have to come and try it for yourselves.
Yeah, really. That's the key. Come and try. Well, thanks again, and we appreciate your time and your knowledge, and hopefully we can talk again sometime. And I hope I'll see you down there sometime.
That would be great. Thanks again, man.
Sure. Our next broadcast will be on March 5th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. In that show, we're going to interview John Travenier, and our topic on the show will be fly fishing the San Juan River in New Mexico. So John's a professional guide on the San Juan River and knows about every inch of this trophy-producing tailwater. So listen in while he tells us his secrets about fly fishing for big trout with little bugs. We'd like to thank ISE, the International Sportsman Exposition, Fly Fusion Magazine, the Federation of Fly Fishers, and Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements. That way you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And, of course, feel free to explore the other areas of our site, like the events calendar and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.